Welcome to the Bill Simmons podcast presented by FanDuel Sportsbook. So I went to the Lakers game last night. It was my first Luka Doncic in-person experience. I got to see some of the number 77 jerseys. Did I look around and wonder, are there more 77s than 23s in the audience? I might have looked at a couple sections and wondered about it, but something cool really happened during the game. Luka came out. He always tests these first quarters. And this is something he always did in Dallas too. You kind of want to watch the first quarter of a Luka game because you never know what the ceiling is going to be. Like at some point he's going to score 75 points in a game. It's going to happen. And he usually tests that first quarter to see if how much he's feeling it. So he does it in this Lakers game. They're playing Denver. There's no Jokic. There's no Murray. Cause God forbid you go to an NBA game and see all the stars on both teams. There's no LeBron either. Luka comes out. He scores 20 of the first 33 points. And you could feel a buzz building in the arena that is the sound you only get to hear when this is happening with Curry, when Curry's hitting threes. You go back in time, like when Kobe was feeling it some nights, when Michael Jordan was feeling it some nights. It's the rarest sound you get at a basketball game where everybody's like, holy shit. You start looking at the scoreboard. So with like 4.5 minutes left, the Lakers had 33 points and he had 20. And now everybody's like out of their minds. They just can't. Oh my, could he score 100? Could he get 30 in the first quarter? Of course, from that point on, he goes down. He's stunk in the second quarter. He wasn't good in the third quarter either. They win easily because the Nuggets had nobody. But the buzz in the arena, and I've been going to Laker games. I moved here in November 2002. The only other time I felt it at a Laker game like that was when Kobe was playing. And I remember the first time I moved to LA in mid-November and I went to a Laker game maybe 2 weeks later. Somebody brought me. I'd never been to a Laker game before. You know, grew up going to Celtic games, East Coast my whole life. Just had always hated the Lakers, hated the Showtime, never really understood it. And I go to this game and the thing that jumped out to me was Kobe and Shaq. It was, you know, it was right after they'd won the three-peat. They lose in that 03 season, but it's Kobe and Shaq. It's, you know, typical really good home game. The thing that jumped out to me just sitting there was like, oh my God, these fans love Kobe. Like they love him. And it was my big takeaway from the night. Like, and there's reasons for that, right? He's drafted by the team. He's a teenager. They get to watch him go through the stages. Then they win titles with him. Shaq shows up from Orlando. He'd been there, I don't know, four years in Orlando, comes to the Lakers. So he's a little bit of a hired gun, kind of like LeBron now. And they love both of them together, but they really love Kobe. And you could feel that during the rest of the run. You get, especially the 06 season. I remember going to a bunch of games that year. It was after the trial. They weren't very good, but he just single-handedly scores 35 points a game. And just at some point after everything that happened with him in Colorado, it changed the tenor of the relationship of the fans with him in a way that people were like, this is our guy. We are sticking with him through thick and thin. Shaq's gone. Our team's not going to be very good, but this is our guy. And you could really feel it that 06 season. And, you know, the only time I can remember with a basketball player was Bird with the Celtics, where it's just like 100% approval rating. Everybody's all in. This is our guy. We believe he can do anything. And I felt like Kobe got to the point with the fans, really in the mid-2000s, you could feel it the most. And there was always buzz with him. And that year was the year, you know, that was the year that that he had that huge Toronto game, the 81. But in general, he was a threat to do whatever night after night after night. LeBron, as great as he is, was always like a totality of what he was doing. Like the, you know, if you love basketball, how do you not absolutely love what he's doing? But the ultimate LeBron game would be like 32 points, 15 assists, 12 rebounds. It's a little like Jokic. Jokic, we're not going to tell our grandkids we were at a game where Jokic had 30, 20, and 15. It's amazing to watch. There's something different when somebody might have the chance to really go off. It's the rarest thing in basketball. And there was that feeling in there for a couple minutes. So it was that plus, you know, there's performance with him where Los Angeles just makes sense. As a team that he plays for, he's working the crowd. At one point in the first quarter, some guy in red, he got fouled And Luca has 20 at that point. He gets fouled. The guy, this dumbass with the drinks, like, ball don't lie. And Luca hears it and he turns around and he starts talking to the guy, talking shit to him. And now he's just interacting with this whole section. He does things that I think are pretty rare from a basketball standpoint. He does hear the crowd. He does interact with people. He does talk shit. He talks shit to the refs. He talks shit to everybody he's playing against. Like, he almost got into it at one point with Peyton Watson, and you're watching, it's like, oh, watch out, Luca's pissed now. He just feels like he belongs in LA. And that was my big takeaway. I was thinking about, like, if you're going to have the perfect Laker for central casting, you'd want somebody who's a little polarizing, which Luca is, right? Great player, hasn't won the title yet, little out of shape, doesn't really play defense. We'll have quarters where he just looks terrible, then a quarter where he's awesome. And there's, like, always the potential of something more. And he's still great. He's still one of the five best players in the league. But it's like, ah, I wonder what else is there. So you have that. You have the performance aspect, which Kobe was unbelievable at. And LeBron's great at too. But Kobe, there was a demeanor to him at these games, especially as he really bought into it. That was just awesome. You have the no ceiling in any game you go to with Luka, which I think is as rare as it gets. And it's the thing that I think made Curry so special the last 10 years. It's like, am I at the game right now where Curry's going to hit 15 threes? Am I at the game right now where Curry's going to get 70? There's a one-on-one aspect with Luka that I think's important. There's nobody in the league remotely like him, like remotely. All the stuff he's doing, like, he got in the first 8 minutes of the game I went to last night. Granted, Denver's missing their two best guys, but he beats everybody off the dribble for 8 minutes in a row. And he's doing the herky-jerky stuff. He's banging people. It's like, it felt like he could post up whoever he wanted. He could go by whoever he wanted. He could make 27-footers. Oh, and he's an awesome passer too. So you have that. You have the Hollywood redemption comeback story because the Mavericks gave up on him. Like, you could say they traded him. They got a lot back. Well, obviously they didn't get a lot back, but they gave up on him. They didn't believe that they could win a title with him. They didn't want to pay him $330 million. LA loves that. You have the Lakers outwitted another team to get him, which is it. I got to be honest. It feels like the Laker fans have their swagger back a little because, you know, you think, like, really since the Kobe Nash Howard year, and then they just sucked forever and they drafted in the top four and the picks were, like, pretty hit or miss and they missed out on guys like Tatum. And then they end up with LeBron basically because LeBron just wanted to move to LA. And then they end up with Davis because LeBron made them trade everything for Davis. So now they end up with those two guys. But for the most part, I wouldn't call it the shrewdest team over the years. Then Reeves is a great pick. And then Luka is the greatest trade in, maybe in the history of the league, at least since the Bill Russell trade. So you have that. And then you have the night to night with Luka where you show up in the building and you don't know where you're going to get. And you can't put a price on that. It goes beyond the trade. It goes beyond, you know, the fact that they fleeced Dallas, that they have somebody who's about to hit the prime of your career. Like, this guy has a chance to be Kobe for these guys. And that's the difference. LeBron came in 2018. He'd been in the league 15 years. He belonged to Cleveland. So it's a business arrangement. It was year to year and it was great and it's worked out awesome and they have a chance to make the finals this year. But it was always a little bit of an arrangement. Kobe is different. And when you go to the Staples and you see the statues when you walk in, and we were talking about, like, last time we're walking in, like, is Luka going to get a statue here someday? You know, the statues are really smart. You go and you see Jerry West, you see Kobe, you see Magic, you see Shaq. And it's like, whose statue were they? Could LeBron get a statue? Maybe. Maybe if they make the finals this year, maybe he's going to get one anyway. But Luka, what's sitting at stake now for him is not only can he become the face of the league, earlier in the year, we're talking about face of the league, face of the league. Like, this is it. This guy has a chance now to be the face of the league. Could he win titles here? Could you get a statue? And could you be one of the big celebrities in LA where night after night after night, people are going to these games to see him, to see what happens with him? And you can feel the buzz already. There's more celebrities at all these games. The energy is different. And I'm not saying it was bad before, but the energy reminded me of what it was like when I went to that Kobe game. It's the same thing. And you kind of either have that or you don't, and he has it. And it's one of the many reasons why that trade is fucking incredibly stupid. So I just wanted to mention that. Let's get to the rest of the podcast. You're listening to the Bill Simmons Podcast presented by FanDuel. FanDuel Sportsbook is the best place to bet on the NBA. We have these fun little Tuesday, Friday player performance stuff. We have same game parlays. We have picks for me sometimes and boosts and all kinds of fun things. Get ready in the playoffs. Download the FanDuel Sportsbook app today to get in on the action. And by the way, The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit theringer.com/RG to learn more. Listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus, present in select states. Gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. Hey, we launched a new podcast for The Ringer and Spotify. It is called Good Hang with Amy Poehler. Two new episodes, Tina Fey and Martin Short. Check it out. It's awesome. We're also brought to you by The Ringer Podcast Network. I put up a new Rewatchables on Monday, Days of Thunder. I got to be honest, I didn't realize how many people liked this movie. A lot of buzz out there. People pumped that we did this. New Prestige TV podcast went up Sunday night after White Lotus. We did episode 5. We have episode 6 in the bank. That is coming Sunday night immediately after White Lotus ends. And then we don't have the screener yet for episode 7. It's going to get dicey, folks. There's only 2 episodes left and we have not seen episode 7. So I will keep you posted. I know you're on the edge of your seat. We're also brought to you by FanDuel Sportsbook. Check them out. And we are going to have Todd McShay talking about the NFL draft a little bit later. But first, Chris Mannix talking Boston Celtics sale and some NBA stuff as well. First, our friends from Pearl Jam. All right, we're bringing in the new owner of the Boston Celtics, Todd McShay. Congratulations. Can't wait to see what you do with the team.
Pretty good money they got for that, huh? Quite the investment.
Yeah, big six with no arena. So you have the McShay show for us. You have the McShay Report, an excellent newsletter that is really becoming more and more exciting as we're within 5 weeks of the NFL draft. And I obviously have some special interest because my favorite team is picking fourth. But I wanted to go through some of the stuff you have in here. I feel bad. Anytime I have you on, I feel like I'm stealing something from Russillo. Do I have to work this out with him? I don't know. I just feel like I'm going into his fridge and grabbing like his grapefruit juice and taking like a big swig.
No,
you're like Team Russillo. I always feel bad.
Yeah, but we're all on the team now, right?
Great. That's a good way to put it. I'm going to tell him that. It's starting to look like 1-2 for the QBs, which is what you laid out in Mock Draft 2.0. Cam Ward to Tennessee, Sanders to the Browns. Can we go through all the breadcrumbs of this Cleveland Browns, Sanders at number 2, please? Let's hear it.
All right. So, I mean, you turned me on to Bazzana? I had to look up who Bazzana was.
Did you like how I was on deep social media trying to find weird people talking about this?
Yeah, I actually did. And I'm sitting here, right? And I'm watching tape and it was running back. So I'm on the 8th or 9th running back and I've got 20 more guys to do. And then we're texting about that. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to stop down for a minute. I thought I was going to take 10 minutes and look through and see. But then I kind of got into my own little deep dive of, all right, so everyone wants to say Shador's got a second round grade for a lot of teams. I talked to two personnel people, right, at the combine who were in the 15 minute interviews with Shador Sanders for teams that are drafting in the top 10 that need a quarterback. And I was surprised that the information that came out was, and I'll kind of paraphrase or summarize. We got the vibe after meeting with all these other players and all the years of doing this. You can sense how important these meetings are for the individual player when they come in. For Shador, with us, we didn't get the sense that he cared an awful lot about what we thought of him.
Right. It was almost like he was meeting with his accountant for 15 minutes or something. He was trying to sell them.
Right. Exactly. And so I'm getting that information. And I look at him as a player who, in certain systems, certain situations, he's got a chance to really succeed in the league, but he's not for everybody. He's not a big, strong arm, mobile quarterback. He's none of those things, right?
And so, because the perception is because it's Deion's son, you just in your head, you're like, oh, he's got to be an amazing athlete. And he's actually a way more traditional quarterback.
It's the biggest surprise you'll see. And he was talking about, I'm going to run faster than my dad. I'm like, I don't know if you're going to, if you were to run a 40, I don't know if you're going to break like 4.8.
Yeah.
So you've got all of that. And now the reports come out from different people in the league. Like, well, we don't even have a first round grade on him. And so I get it, because in the teams that are willing to talk are the teams that don't have interest, right? So that's kind of the backdrop. And then you send me some of that stuff. And I had heard that Cleveland's a place that he has interest in, but that's a short list. And there are some teams, and I think those teams that I talked to that he didn't have the overwhelming interviews with are the ones that are on the list where Coach Prime's been telling us since what, October, November, that there's going to be some teams that my son's just not going to go play for. So you start to put all these things together. And I just took a minute and I went back and I looked at Kevin Stefanski's history. What has made him successful? What has he been successful with? Well, Case Keenum, he won 11 games with.
Wow.
As a coach. Kirk Cousins, he won 10 games with. And a quarterback coach, offensive coordinator, like hands-on with those guys. And so it got me thinking, like, the skill sets are the same. Not big, not mobile, not elite arms, but process quickly. That's his secret sauce. That's what
Would you put Flacco in there?
Flacco, modern day Flacco, still has a big arm, but not like, you know, the Baltimore Ravens in his prime Flacco, yeah. And has never been overly mobile. So he's winning games with these guys who are pocket passers, don't have these traits, but they all process quickly. They're accurate passers. That's what Shador is. And so now I'm looking at it, I'm saying Cleveland is in purgatory salary cap wise because of the Deshaun Watson deal. So if I'm Andrew Berry, and I don't have any information that's saying Cleveland is taking Shador, just to make that clear. But if I'm Andrew Berry and I'm saying, all right, the salary cap's horrible this year, and it's not going to be any better next year. We maybe can get a Russell Wilson or make a trade for Kirk Cousins, but that's just temporary. That could help us win some games this year while we're developing a young quarterback, whether that's for later in his rookie year or for year two. Yeah. But we got to get to year two. Because if we're drafting this high next year and talking about like Garrett Nussmeier from LSU or Carson Beck or whoever the quarterbacks are going to be next year, we're probably not the decision makers here in Cleveland. We probably job. Like,
they have to get to year two, not the Browns.
Correct.
The people making the pick have to get to year two.
Correct. So it makes sense that you bring in Kenny Pickett as a backup, and maybe he does better things than all of us expect. If forced into duty, exactly. But why are they still in the market for these veterans? Well, they're not going to cost anything. And so it's their only up. They weren't in it for Stafford. They're not in it for Aaron Rodgers. But if they can bring in someone to help win games, whether it's the whole year or part of this rookie year for a Shador Sanders, that gives them a shot. And then if you have Shador, there's energy, there's excitement about the future. And Stefanski's one of the handful of guys in the league that I believe could get the most out of Shador and actually win a lot of games with.
So we're checking a bunch of different boxes that make the NFL draft and the NBA draft so much fun, right?
Yes.
There's desperation.
Uh-huh.
You have decision makers like, I might not be here in a year. What's my big swing? Well, we have no salary cap space. I have the second pick in the draft. Nobody's really going to probably trade up for this. And even if they do, I won't have a quarterback. We're going 6-11, 7-10 next year. So you have that. You have the Myles Garrett piece, who was going to leave, get a trade. Something happened. He gave that one interview where they asked him, are you comfortable with what's going to happen at quarterback? And he's like, oh, yes, I am. I was like, oh, what is it? Why is he comfortable now? There's no free agent. It's not Russell Wilson's not making him comfortable.
I wouldn't think so.
Flag that one. Then you have Sanders like playing footsie on social media with the top Indians prospect, which I thought was notable. You have the dad who, if his son goes second in the NFL draft, it's more money, it's more prestige, all that stuff. Cleveland.
And his dad, like we can say all the things you want about Coach Prime and he's not for everybody. And the way he handles things is kind of against the establishment. So there's obviously always going to be pushback, right? But he is dialed into the league and he knows the guys that can help develop his son. And at the end of the day, as a father,
right,
all you want to do is put your children in a position where they can help them get the best of what they are, no matter what their career path is. And so I think he looks at it and with his connections in the league and his understanding, and he looks at it and says, you know what? I'm in a good position. Yes, he makes more money if he goes picks one, two, or three. But also with that, and it's kind of unique, there are three guys that are running the organization as head coaches that actually can coach quarterbacks. And he's not going number one where Brian Callahan is, but Stefanski's an outstanding quarterback developer and can work with him. And Brian Daboll, well, he's worked with bigger, you know, Josh Allen's and Jalen Hurts at Alabama. He's worked with guys that have different traits. Brian Daboll can coach quarterbacks really well.
Right.
So I think the combination of, yeah, he gets more money, but probably just as, if not more importantly, I trust where he's going to go and the people who are going to be working with.
Yeah, and as people listen to this, they're going to be like, well, of course Simmons wants him to go second because it's going to push out the two best guys.
You should have seen my comments after I came out and I started talking about this. They're like, oh, yeah. Simmons got to you, right? And my answer is, yeah, like he got me thinking. There's no question. He got me thinking with some of the social media stuff that I was oblivious to because I'm sitting here watching like RJ Harvey, the running back from UCF.
Well, to
right
be
now.
Fair, this started in Cleveland. Like there's people that cover the team. There's people who follow the team and they're just kind of reading the tea leaves. And it's for a lot of the reasons you mentioned. It's they really are the only chance for them to get a quarterback who might make it. And this is the most fun part of the stretch for the draft where you have 50-50 odds usually with a quarterback this high, right? This might be 40-60, but you start looking hard at the 40. I'm like, well, Stefanski. Well, we have a good foundation around him. Well, we have no chance to get a quarterback. What if we can turn him into something? Like, you know, Russillo has the theory. He would just take a quarterback every year in the first round, I think, because it's like, let's just keep throwing the darts and at some point until you hit the balloon.
Right.
In this case, if you're them, you have no other way to get a quarterback and you are absolutely murdered by the Deshaun thing.
Yeah.
The Giants one, that's a little tougher one because they're not in the same salary cap hell that the Browns are in. And
they're not, but no one wants to. But Matthew Stafford, at the end of the day, he was offered the same, and I've even heard reports maybe like a little bit more to go to New York.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at it and I say I get 2-3 years left, I'm not certain that Joe Shane and more importantly Brian Daboll is going to be there for 2 or 3 years. What's the stability
about
of the
one year? They're in the same desperation thing, right? They hit on Sanders, they can save the jobs.
Yes. So that's why. For the majority of people I talk to in the league, Bill, it is a later first, maybe early second round grade for Shador. But for the teams that are in these very unique situations, Cleveland at 2 and the Giants at 3, they have circumstances that require them to make decisions that maybe they wouldn't make if they had 6 years left on their contract. They'd done a lot of winning and they didn't, you know, they wanted a quarterback, but they didn't need to reinvigorate the fan base and more importantly, show promise towards the future. So
this isn't Mitch Trubisky either, because this kid comes with real fame already. People have watched him in college. They've watched him do good things. They like his dad. He's got some pizzazz, whereas like Trubisky, it's like, hey, he started 13 games, and he's like Darko Milicic, basically. Hey, on paper, this guy's amazing, and there's really no evidence at all. And
he faced no adversity, didn't have to come back for a second year where defensive coordinators had seen it the first time around. Like, Shador, here's the thing that I find interesting. First of all, when you watch the tape, he's tough as nails. So forget all like the diamonds and the commercials and all that stuff.
Yeah.
This guy is an old school throwback pocket passing, stare down the gun barrel, take the hits and pop back up type of quarterback. Okay.
Right.
And the other part is too, it's interesting talking to people in the league. To a T, it's like, yeah, Prime's getting all the media attention and people think that that's a headache. He's not going to be a headache when Shador comes here. In fact, and I don't want to go into a lot of detail and it's speculation and when one person's thoughts on it versus another's, but Cam Ward's got a father apparently who's been very involved. And so there's talk in the league of like, and it's not going to affect where Cam goes. He's going to be the first pick in the draft. But like the interesting part to people in the league is like, we'd be a little bit more worried about the externals with Cam than we are with Shador right. and Coach Prime. Yeah.
And he's also had a big spotlight on him for the last couple of years, right? And abnormally large for a QB. There's one other piece. So you were talking about how he didn't do well in a couple of those interviews, right? Yep. Or the vibes were off and it...
Yeah, nothing was disrespectful.
No, just like, doesn't seem like he's that interested in coming to our team.
He knows something that maybe we just don't know. And
right. So there's an NBA version of this during the COVID draft when LaMelo ends up going second to Charlotte. And the story I always heard was they have to do Zoom interviews and it's like the most fucked up draft process ever. And they do the LaMelo thing and he's just really off in it. And he's distant and just seems like he doesn't really give a shit about the Warriors. And it affected how they thought about, you know, whether they should take him or not. And then it turns out he probably knew he was going, you know, Charlotte. He probably wanted to go there.
Right.
And you kind of perform what your expectations are for where you want to go, right? So if it's a team, and I could totally see it. If it's a team you don't really want to go to, you turn into Tom Cruise in Risky Business where you're like, I don't really want to go to University of Illinois. I want to go to Princeton.
Right.
So if he has an inkling that he could go second, he knows in Cleveland, like obviously LeBron was there. Like you can become a big star in Cleveland, but I can see it. It's a good situation because their team wasn't bad last year. Like it's not, they're not that far away from being a little more impactful, maybe, if they had a decent QB.
No, and they need a running back, and this just so happens to be the best running back class, maybe in the history of the draft, and certainly since 2017.
Yeah,
and you know they're not that far away. They're really not. And I go through it. If I'm Shador and I've got assurances that it could be Cleveland, but if it's not, it's very likely going to be the Giants. I think that probably led to what you were just talking about too. You know?
And there's no trade up team, we don't think, because the Raiders got Geno. I don't think that the Jets just went in on Fields. I don't see them trading up anyway. And then the Saints.
I do hear that the Jets could throw us a curveball the first night. Let's just get it out here now. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I think there's a little bit of love for Jackson Dart in that building.
Oh, it seems like he's the Bo Nix of this draft.
Absolutely.
Bo Nix ends up going, what, 12?
He went 12.
Seemed inconceivable. He was second round. Oh, maybe late first round. Then all of a sudden he's 12.
And if it wasn't Denver, it was probably going to be second round.
Yeah.
And that place, it just, Sean Payton fell in love with him. Perfect fit. And that's how it worked out. And listen, Jackson Dart doesn't go 7, which again, I'm maybe let's put a 25-30% chance at most at this point. New Orleans is a possibility at 9. But then after
another team that's in salary cap hell and just completely screwed and have to get a quarterback somehow.
Right. And everyone's like, well, they brought Derek Carr back. Yeah, one more year. But this would actually be a perfect time to get a rookie quarterback as we work through all the salary stuff, not force him out there for year one. So I think Jackson Dart could be a top 10 pick. But if he's not, then it's like, you know, we talk about 21 to Pittsburgh or a team. That's the other thing. Either the Browns or the Giants are very likely to take Shador. Whichever team doesn't, the Browns are picking at 33, which is the first pick of the second round. The Giants are picking one spot after that. I think you'll see one of those teams, whichever one doesn't get a quarterback, wind up moving into the first round. Maybe it's to pick 19 to Tampa or 20 to Denver to try to secure Jackson Dart. And also to get that fifth year in the NFL, there's a fifth year option for the first round players. So you want to get that for that extra year of security as an organization.
Well, in the McShay Report, a very excellent newsletter that everybody should subscribe to, it pops right into it. It's like, I woke up this morning, 7 o'clock, I'm looking at text, Celtics all of a sudden got sold. Then your newsletter came. I'm like, what a great morning. I haven't even had coffee yet.
It's
You have the Giants trading up to 19 for Dart. You had a fake trade. 34 and 65 and a 26 third rounder to the Bucks.
Yeah.
For pick number 19. So in that scenario, the two quarterbacks go 1-2. They take Hunter third. And I want to talk about that in a second. And then move up and take Dart. And now they're like, we've got Dart. We've got Neighbors.
Yeah.
Yo, Travis Hunter. Who knows? Maybe he'll play both sides of the ball. And all of a sudden now there's energy with the Giants.
Absolutely. And let's bring it back to the top four, right? It's a puzzle.
Yeah.
And we know we've got one of the four pieces of the puzzle with those four picks. I feel very strongly like we've got it planted in there, right? So now figuring out the other three, it's almost like the rest of the draft starts at pick five.
Yeah.
Like Mason Graham and Tyler Warren and the running backs and all this. But the first four picks, it's like, how does this work, right?
Well, and let me stop you one second there.
Yeah.
I refuse to read another mock draft that doesn't have those four going in some order. Yes. I still see drafts from like good places where they're like number four, Patriots, Will Campbell, and then Jacksonville takes Abdul Carter at five. And I'm like, I promise you that's not happening.
No, no.
If Abdul Carter is at four, they're taking Abdul Carter.
And I put it in there because I wound up with Abdul Carter in the newsletter in the mock draft 2.0. I put Abdul Carter in there, but I'm very, very clear to my friends here in New England, like, don't get overly excited because a lot has to happen.
So don't buy the jersey yet. Tell my buddy J-Bug. Like, don't buy it yet. Wait till like end of April.
But if Shador goes two or three, you can buy two jerseys and get rid of one of them because it's going to be Hunter or Carter, period.
But Hunter makes a whiff more sense for the Giants, but I thought you laid it out correctly. It makes a little more sense, but if they took Carter, it's not like that's stupid. They would just have an amazing defensive line.
I think they've prepared like most good organizations do, and I'm not saying the Giants have been, but organizations are in free agency, are trying to free themselves up to take the best player in the draft. The Giants obviously have Kayvon Thibodeau and Brian Burns at edge. So you look at it and you say, it's not a huge need, but who cares? Like when you get a player like that at the second most important position, you take him. And so if it goes where Shador is number two, they have their choice. And so that's a good position to be in. But what if Abdul goes one or two? Or what Abdul goes two,
yeah, right?
And they're sitting there three and Hunter's the only guy. Or if Hunter goes two and then Abdul's sitting there, they've got to make sure that they're covered. They re-signed Darius Slayton at wide receiver. They Paulson Adebo at cornerback. So they're covered, but they're talking about excellence versus just solid players. And so,
well, you put him and Neighbors together just from an athlete standpoint.
Yes. And now you have
who knows. Yeah.
And then the opportunity to go get a Jackson Dart with that, as you had mentioned. So there's a lot of ways this can play out. But for New England, the only thing you really truly have to pray for is that Shador goes number two or three, because then you get either the best or the second best player in this entire draft falling to you at four. And that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, otherwise you're looking at a trade back. And in a trade back, I don't know who's trading up and what you're getting. I mean, I told you my dream trade would be the Jets move up to four, Pats get Garrett Wilson, Pats give up their second round pick. So it's basically 7 and 39 for, you know, four, like whatever. The Pats end up with 7 and Garrett Wilson in the deal. And I'm like, I'd sign up for that. Why would the Jets do that? I have no idea. But that's my dream.
Yeah, that's where you lose me. I mean, you had me on the show. No,
I had you. Yeah, I had
but
you.
I
can't apologize for my dreams.
No, not at all.
But the thing with the Pats is, I'm not a big draft for need guy when you're not one guy away from winning the Super Bowl. This Pats thing's going to be like a 3-year, you know.
Completely.
They don't need to be like, we need a left tackle because that way we'll go 8 and 9 next year. Like they just need awesome players. And it really doesn't matter what position they are.
Well, the problem is though, if you're New England, if Shador doesn't go, right? Let's say Cleveland and the Giants pass and it goes Abdul Carter 2, Hunter 3 or vice versa.
You're in Membo range.
Yes. And Membo's
you're
right
taking
tackle.
Taking him 3-4 spots too high, Membo's but right you kind of have to do it. Right.
Membo's a right tackle in college. And can he kick to the left side? Are they comfortable with that? And Will Campbell's a pure left tackle, but he's got 32.5-inch arm length. And that's concerning when you're using a top 10 pick. You just want it to be clean. And so, and then you got Jalen Walker from Georgia, who would do great things. Edge rusher who would do great things in Mike Vrabel's defense. But again, you're talking about elite. And no matter what the draft, Travis Hunter, Abdul Carter are elite. They're in that top tier. To then like, it could be one of like 6 or 7 guys with very similar grades. And now we are focusing more on the need.
No, it's Lombardi's old thing about blue chippers. We call them red chippers. And then the guys below that. But the teams that usually are around the Super Bowl sniffing around, you look and they have 5, 6, 7, 8 blue chippers.
Yes.
The Pats only have Gonzalez and Drake May right now. Plus the nose tackle they got from the Eagles.
What's your blood pressure going to be like when Cleveland and the Giants come up to, you know, to make their, like during that 25,
well, don't you think
30?
We'll know with Cleveland and Sanders, right? Like that's not going to leak out.
Yeah, probably.
It's a lot
yeah.
of people with interest in that.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Yeah, probably. But still, like until you hear the name.
Because the only thing that worries me is, are the Browns, I would do this if I ran a team. Like, do you pretend you're drafting Sanders because you want to see if the Giants are going to flip out and maybe offer you something to flip picks with you? And you wanted Abdul Carter all along.
Yeah, of course you do.
I always feel like I'm just going to represent that I'm going to potentially
but
take somebody.
But the Giants would know, unless you're a team behind trying to, the Giants would know if you're willing to give up that pick, you're not taking them.
But they could say, if you don't swap picks with us, we have somebody that's coming in hard.
That's the
we
play.
Might move back
the
to 7, 8, 9.
The Jets are a surprise team. The Saints, whoever. Yes.
And then you have the Giants are now trying to use all their intel, like find out from our guy in the Jets how real this is. And that's what makes the draft so much fun. You're basically all playing poker with each other, but it's some of the worst poker players who ever lived.
Yes.
So the biggest questions are Carter versus the other than the QBs, Carter versus Hunter, just who has more value. And that really seems like whoever just needs whatever they do more, but they're pretty equal. You have Carter above Hunter, but not by a shitload, right? It's like
they're basically
hair.
Identical. The tricky part for Hunter is what's the plan, right? And for a team like New England, I've got to believe it's, you don't have Drake May and say, yeah, we just drafted this guy 4 overall, generational talent. He's going to be a nickel corner as a rookie and eventually our starting corner. You might get 20 plays with him on offense. It's just not going to happen. So everyone is talking about the moonlighting where you'd like to play him at corner because that's the harder position in terms of developing and the technique and being part of 11 there, whereas wide receivers a little bit more ISO, it's kind of like an NBA thing, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of one-on-one stuff. For New England, I can't imagine that would be the case. I think it would be, you're a full-time receiver. We've got our biggest asset in this entire organization is Drake May. And so we've got to assist that.
And this is our best chance to get a number one receiver because we struck out trying to get all these different guys. Now you're looking at Stephon Diggs and Brandon Ayuk and people are coming off major injuries. It gets a little, it's a receiver draft that sucks.
Yeah. So it depends on the team, but I'll say this. I think Travis Hunter is more advanced as a wide receiver right now. I think Travis Hunter can be Garrett Wilson and with maybe like a touch more juice after the catch. So I would have no problem with him being a 50 snap a game offensive player and 25, you know, third downs, red zone, that kind of stuff on defense. If you can manage all that.
It sounds like such a fun wrinkle for whoever gets him, where if you play him at receiver, but he's also like your dime back. And it's just like, he's in now. Oh my God, he picked one off. Like just,
it's kind of like when Deion would come on the field to return a punt or kick. Do you remember
or when he would line up at receiver, it was like so exciting. It's like, oh my God, are they going to throw it to him?
Right.
So that would be cool. This tournament season, FanDuel has given you the power to take control of your bets. Introducing the Bet Back Token, the ultimate game changer that lets you bail on any bet that's not going your way. By turning it into bonus bets. It's simple. If one of your bets is not heading in the right direction in the game, go to your My Bet section, tap the token, get your stake back immediately in bonus bets, just like that. Right now, for the tourney, FanDuel is giving all customers a bet back token. It's just a shame the Mavericks couldn't have gotten this for the Luka trade. Just head over to FanDuel.com/BS to grab your bet back token today. Only on America's number one sportsbook. You must be 21 plus in president select states or 18 plus in president DC. Opt-in required, refund issued as a non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Max refund $5, unless otherwise specified. Restrictions apply, including token expiration. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Game problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Audi, the all-new fully electric Audi Q6 e-tron. A huge leap forward featuring effortless power, serious acceleration, and the most advanced tech of any Audi ever. Experience technology that puts you center stage with a panoramic digital stage. Plus, an optional screen for front seat passengers. That sounds fun. Perfect for watching the latest sports documentary. Maybe I made it. The Q6 e-tron is not just a new EV. It's a new way to experience driving. Learn more at AudiUSA.com. Always pay careful attention to the road. Do not drive while distracted. Then the draft really starts at 5.
Yeah.
And you had Mason Graham going to the Jags in mock draft 2.0.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The running backs are fascinating to me too, though.
Right. So I was going to say that the Boise State kid at 6 to the Raiders, but then you also love Hampton, and we could have two running backs in the top 12, even though one of the only things we've learned about the draft is don't take running backs that high.
Right.
It's a disposable position. Like, right. I was looking at the 2016 draft in the NFL. Don't ask why. And like, everybody in that draft seems so old now. Like, Zeke Elliott's in it. 2016 draft is like not that long ago. Like, Jaylen Brown was in the 2016 draft. And
isn't
he's
crazy?
Just hitting the prime of his career. And Zeke Elliott seems like he's 48.
Right.
So you think about that with running backs, and it's like, all right, so I'm going to draft somebody that I have for 6 years. I get Mason Graham. He might play till he's 36. He might have two giant contracts.
Cam Hayward's what, 36 now? So
right.
Yeah.
So if you're taking a running back that high, you better think it's like, this is Saquon Barkley, Bijan Robinson.
For each of those teams, you look at the Raiders and like some of their other positions, like wide receiver, there's no receiver to draft that high. Some of the other positions, cornerback, like Jahdae Barron from Texas, but it's not like, we're not talking about, you know, one of those like elite corners. You look at what Pete Carroll has had, and he's not necessarily, you know, going to be the, it depends on what his role winds up being, but Tom Brady is going to play a big part in all of this too. But from the standpoint of how they want to build it, you want to have a great defense. They want to recapture some of the Legion of Doom stuff. They want to have a running back like a Marshawn Lynch who
a
can
big
be
banger.
That.
Yeah.
A big banger. Protect the ball, let the defense take care of a lot of the business on the field. And that's what Ginty is in terms of an every down back. He like the missed tackles forced and like he's a special back. So that it makes sense for that organization and for that pick where they are, because it's not like they're passing on this elite pass rusher or corner or wide receiver that they shouldn't for a running back. And then for Chicago, they handle their business so well in free agency.
Yeah.
Three offensive linemen. They're protecting their quarterback. They could go tackle with that spot if Will Campbell's still there. But I also, I have concerns enough with drafting a 32.5-inch arm tackle in the top 10. And if we bring in a running back to go with DeAndre Swift, how much more are we protecting our quarterback by having two backs? And so if one goes down, we still have a top shelf back. If both are in there, they're keeping each other fresh. We can run the football. We can take some pressure. I don't know. And we saw what Ben Johnson did with Jahmyr Gibbs and how quickly that offense went from, you know, 90 to 100 with the one player,
so,
really.
So if Will Campbell had 34-inch arms, he'd be the fourth pick in the draft.
Could be, yeah. Isn't that crazy? There's only three starting tackles in the league at the end of the year with sub 33-inch arms. So you're playing it's kind of Parcells used to say, we don't want a roster full of exceptions, you know? So that part's concerning.
If you're a GM, would you ever take a running back in the top 12?
No.
I don't think I would either.
Especially not this year when I'm looking at guys like Quinshon Judkins from Ohio State and Cam Scadaboo, who's his tape I liked even more than I thought after watching the awesome things he did this season.
That's my dream scenario for the third round for the Pats.
I don't know that he's going to get. Yeah, I don't know that he's going to get there. He might not. But even if not, you got R.J. Harvey from UCF. You've got D.J. Giddens from Kansas.
Yeah, but
State.
You know this though. When there's too many, guys start dropping because nobody ends up taking. Like even think about last year with the wide receivers that got so stupid, and the Pats ended up with the 10th guy in the first 35 picks. So it was a receiver,
right?
You know, I think there's a. They Hulk, know all yeah. of a sudden Cooper goes to the Eagles at 39. He's the third best defensive back on the board. I don't know. I just feel like when there's a glut, it really fucks things up.
And sometimes though, when you look at it and say, well, I can get those guys later. Sometimes it's like, hold, hold, you know, and then all of a sudden one goes and there will be this run. But I think everyone's going to kind of wait to see where the dominoes start to fall before they jump in. Because no one wants to draft a running back over some of these other premium positions, even if you're talking about pick 40. Yeah. They'd rather wait.
But I would say the Gibbs and the success Detroit had with him as a weapon would make people think like, maybe in the 12 to 15 range. I always look with the draft, you know, and I'm already starting to think about NFL over-unders and the win totals. And can somebody get, like when the Eagles got Jalen Carter that year, it's like, oh, that's that getting that guy at nine. Jesus, like that might affect. And when you look at the teams that are picking the first 15.
Yep.
The one that jumped out to me was the team you mentioned, the Bears. And I have no idea if they're going to be good. And they're in a brutal division. And who knows with Caleb. But they spent a lot of money. They have the QB on the rookie scale. And then if they just crush the 10th pick somehow and got somebody awesome, then you just have to start thinking like, look at this. Like that Tyler Warren, the tight end. I don't know where he's going to go. He could go 5. He could go 12. But like if they got him at 10, that's somebody that could play right away and be, you know, potentially like an impact dude right away. So that was the team I was looking at. And then the only other one was Atlanta, just because I think Atlanta with Penix and they have some talent, the division sucks. Like if they are able to nail that pick, that could be a good one too.
Going back to the Bears, it's kind of what I said earlier, like the good teams, they plug all the holes so that they can pick the best player available. They do have a luxury pick, and you would say, well, how do the Bears have a luxury pick? Well, that would be to a certain degree a luxury pick, but it fits what they want to do.
Yeah.
But the other part of it is maybe you stay at 10 and you draft an offensive tackle, or maybe you draft an edge rusher, like a Mikel Williams from Georgia.
Yeah.
Because they are picking at, I've got it right here, 39 and 41 in the second round.
Yeah.
And so if I love Omarion Hampton from UNC at running back. But what if I just take a stab at one of these pass rushers and look at what like the Eagles.
What if I load up on my D? Yeah.
Load up on my D. Go get Cam Scadaboo. Go get Quinshon Judkins, one of those guys at 39. I can still draft an offensive lineman or defensive player with that 41st pick. So there's different ways to look at all of this. And that's why I think it's going to be fascinating. We're going to see at least two running backs in the first round. I think three. I don't know that we're going to see two in the top 10, but we
could. I can't believe that. You know? And that's what with T-Mac, I wonder, like, this is the reverse of a glut. When there's nobody at a position, he's the only probably first round graded wide receiver. He's one of the only two that you could even see going in there. And somebody just needs a receiver, and you get people in our office like, fuck it, we need a receiver. And all of a sudden, he's going 11th, you know, because we see that version of the draft, too. You're taking him here?
I think everyone wants to be so quick to look at the highlights and the spectacular plays, and they are spectacular. And then they want to look at his size, and then they want to look at the report from Schultz, was it, that where he ran a 4.48. I talked to some scouts. They had closer to 4.45, somewhere in that range. Oh. Regardless, I don't see the dog in him, and I don't see the refinement. And Drake London wasn't overly refined. He needed a year before he could be a 1,000-plus yard receiver. But that's the comp, right? Tall, just acrobatic type of guy. But they're, yes, the shades of, but they're not the same player. So,
but does somebody look better if there's not a lot of competition in a draft,
absolutely.
And then they start to look like the hottest girl at the bar?
Absolutely, and he will go. I mean, he could go as high as Dallas at 12, let's say. But I had him going later in the first round. I had him going to the Ravens, kind of at that point, best player available. They could use another receiver.
Yeah.
Probably go somewhere in between that range when it's all said and done. But I'm betting on Matthew Golden from Texas. If you need a receiver, like that's why I gave
you
Dallas.
So you have two. Okay.
I've got two. And then Emeka Ibuka could be the third that sneaks in from Ohio State. We'll see how he runs at his pro day. But he would be the third that I think has a good chance to go.
All right, two more questions.
Let me give you another name real quick.
Yeah.
If you're not getting the receiver that first pick at 38 for New England, Jaden Higgins from Iowa State. Do a little work on him.
I've watched some YouTube on him.
They're looking for
Feel a little burned receiver. After Polk last year in the 30s with the receiver. I'm hurt. My guard's up.
I know, but I'm just saying he's a name that fits what they're looking for.
Second to last question. Who is the holy shit this guy's going here, top 15 guy, if you had to guess, the guy who just goes 10, 11 spots higher than you ever could imagine. Last year would have been Bo Nix. Like if we were talking about that yep. draft 5 weeks before the draft, they're like, and you said Bo Nix is going to go 12. I would have been like, what? That's insane. He's not going 12. Who is the that's insane guy?
I think Jackson Dart could be. I'm just looking at it right now.
Is there a weird left tackle, like maybe on paper guy that we're not, that could be late? Like Membo already rose up in the top 10.
I'll give you a guy. Everyone coming out of the combine, Nicky Minwori, right, from South Carolina. Really good player.
Yeah.
I don't think an elite player yet. I think he's still getting there. I think used in the right scheme. I'd love to see him Seattle would be a perfect spot, right? McDonald, the way what he did with Baltimore, Hamilton, I could see that being a really good marriage. But Emenwori was like almost 6'4", 220 pounds. His combination of like size, 40 time, which is a 4.4 flat, and vertical broad jump, it had never been done in the history of the combine. Like he's that special of an athlete. It was awesome to watch. I still think the other safety who ran after him and ran a pedestrian time and didn't jump like him. And I think Malachi Starks from Georgia could wind up being a top 15 pick ahead of Emenwori. And I think that would surprise people right now.
Last question. Russillo stretches for a half hour, goes out to Manhattan and tries to run the 40, but he's stretched. He's limber and he's ready. And we have scouts there and a stopwatch. What is Russillo running right now in the 40?
We haven't talked about this publicly, but there's no better place to do it. I texted Russillo the other day with the old line the town, the movie, you know,
like, yeah.
I can't tell you what we're going to do. You can't.
Whose car are we taking? Anyone.
And I said, your answer needs to be whose car are we going to take?
Right.
And that was in regards to, I want to take over his house for the third day of the draft and do a live stream from there. And we're going to do that.
Sounds great.
So we're announcing that right now without permission, but I figure,
yeah.
Who's going to yell at me? You, right? But I would love to do that as part of the day three of the draft to get Russillo to run. I'm going to guess.
Because he's got a lot of muscle right now, which I think would hurt for the speed, but it also may help. Maybe he's in great shape. I don't know.
4.93.
4.93.
Yes.
So you're under 5.
He's a friend.
That's fair. That was really, really nice of you.
Yeah, I thought so.
So publicly, you'll go 4.93.
I would be more interested in like the three cone or the short shuttle. The lateral agility with all that weightlifting, I just can't see that ending well.
What weightlifting out of all those things they do in that, what would he crush?
The bench press.
Yeah.
The bench.
So huge bench press. That's what the teams are talking about after. Like, yes. Jesus, Russillo benched 580.
But I don't see him as a fullback. So I'm trying to figure out where we're going to roll him up.
Oh, you see him like a, what was that guy in the Niners? Juszczyk?
Yeah.
Just like a guy Belichick would have taken in 2007. Just like special, I just want him for special teams.
Special teamer effort.
I like his attitude.
Yeah. Kind of like that celebrity basketball game he played in. I'll never forget that.
Oh, he's still mad about it. He'll talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
All right, McShay, subscribe to his newsletter. It's great. Listen to the McShay Show. Also great. You can find that on YouTube as well. Great to see you as always.
All right, you too, bud.
Chris Mannix is here. You can read him on Sports Illustrated. You can listen to his podcast. What's the podcast called? Open Floor still?
Open Floor, yeah.
Open Floor. Where was that on the title list as you were coming up with title names? Is it the top one or like two taken?
Yeah.
Titles are so hard now.
Yeah. I think this was back like, I started that podcast before I left for Yahoo. So like, it was back then.
Wow.
Like, let's just call it basketball or something like that.
They're like, no, got to keep going. Speaking of basketball, an 8-episode HBO drama could be written about the Celtics sale, where we found out today $6.1 million to somebody that 12 hours ago, nobody knew who he was. I mean, probably some rich people knew who he was. People knew he was the final bidder, but now Bill Chisholm is going to be the next owner of the Boston Celtics. He paid a record price. It was not an accident where Washington, the Commanders, went for 6.05. Celtics go for 6-1. I have a million thoughts, but what was your immediate reaction to the price?
Astonished. I didn't believe they would get over six. Look, that's a record. That's a huge number regardless. But the fact that you're just selling the team and you're not selling an arena, that is a huge variable in all this. Like yeah. When Matt Ishbia bought Phoenix for a $4 billion valuation, he was getting the arena with it. He was getting, for whatever it's worth, a WNBA team with it. You're just getting the Boston Celtics here. And yeah, it's an iconic franchise, but it's a franchise that is cost a lot of money, is set to have the highest payroll ever, you know, next year. You're taking on something with a lot of bills. So I guess my first reaction was bravo to H. Irving Grausbeck and the lawyers that he hired to sell this team, because I really believe that he got this. He got the absolute maximum value that is possible to extract from the Celtics at this point. So I give him, that was my first reaction. Like, wow, they got a price that I didn't believe they were going to get.
My first reaction, because I love being right, was I was saying last summer that this was going to get to six and that's what the NBA wanted. And guess what? It got to six. I think that was a huge thing for the NBA with the expansion coming. Six has to be the number. That's what we want. I think it was a big thing for the family, especially Irv, the 90-year-old legend, who was not going to have any sort of inside job. There's a whole Steve Pagliuca, who's the number two owner of the Celtics right now, that everybody assumed he was going to get it. And I can't wait to dive into that piece with you. Mm-hmm. It was made clear from the beginning. There's no inside job. This will go to the highest bidder. The most money wins this. And nobody really believed it, but that's how it played out and got to 6-1. And my guess is that the Pagliuca group and maybe even one or two of the other ones got to the six. The point one is so fascinating to me. The point one, sometimes this is how it goes. This is how Larry Ellison lost the Warriors, where it's like, no, he had it. Then the other side, I think, went to, I forget what it was, like 400, 360, whatever it was. And he's like, nope, that's my final offer. And he didn't get it. And it, over and over again, the guys that get these teams are the ones that are like, oh, you want to break the Washington record? All right, point one, done. And that was it. That's how he got it. So the Steve Pagliuca piece is incredible that he didn't get it and that he came really close. And he did a long post today that was posted on social media. That was, I think, one of the strangest posts I've ever read from somebody who didn't own a team. I couldn't believe he did that.
I would call that corporate scorched earth, right? Like, it's not scorched earth like Dan Gilbert on LeBron, but it's corporate scorched earth, where I thought the most telling part of that, was it five paragraph statement that he released, was at the very end of, I think it was the first paragraph, where he noted that he had put together a group of investors that were eager to continue to reinvest in the team. I think the last sentence was luxury tax be damned. Like, what Steve Pagliuca is doing there is he is planting the seed to be like on the other side of future Celtic fan outrage. Because we all know there are some tough decisions that this ownership group is going to have to make in the next couple of years. Like, Sam Hauser makes $10 million right now. In real dollars, right, though, that's like $80 million he's costing this team. There are decisions that they're going to have to make. What Steve Pagliuca, in my mind, did with that statement was just put himself in a position where if this team does cut some corners over the next couple of years, lop off some salaries, he can sit there and be like, you know what? I would have done that. I put together a group of guys that weren't going to do that. Like, he set himself up. We can get into the dynamics there of
ownership. Oh, we're doing it right now. Group.
Okay.
This is the number one thing I want to talk about.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just, so you have these two guys. Wick's dad puts up the most money for the team. Wick's the one that's organizing the group. And it starts out, I think, with four people that put up the money. They get the price, and then their job after they get the price is to then go find a group of minority people to then take off, offload some of the money they just committed to, which, by the way, that's what Chisholm's doing right now. Mm. He's already put the feelers out. trying to put together a little syndicate to offload some of the money that he's already promised. So that's in motion now. So they get the four, but Pags was always, it was like Wick and he's the owner and the dad put up the most money, but also here's Pags. And they've had this uneasy co-owner alliance, but Wick was always the face of it. And it was always a little awkward and you could feel it when there was like a trophy. You know, that's when that Lazary and Edens had that too. Some of these co-owner, like Goober and Lakob, same thing, where it's like, it's my team, but you have to be here. And you hold, let's hold the trophy together. And it's always super awkward. And I don't know how great it was going by the end, because I think when Pagliuca tried to buy the Nets, and I don't think Wick found out from Pagliuca, is my understanding. And I don't think it's been great since then. And I think the reverse of that was Pagliuca found out that the Celtics were being sold the same way we all did. He was not tipped. He was not given a heads up. So I don't think that relationship has been great for the last year. And this specifically, the way he reacted to the sale tells me that this is going to get ugly. And I have some reasons for why this got bad near the end, but what else have you heard on this?
I've seen it unfold over the last 20 years, and you can unequivocally say it was a lot stronger at the beginning than it was at the end.
Yeah.
And some of that has everything to do with what you said there. Like, Pagliuca is in this kind of with his own cash to what, I don't know what the final percentage is that he owned of this group. I heard around 8 or 9%, something in that ballpark. And he's looking at Wick Grousebeck, who owns a lesser percent of the team, but is effectively H. Irving in all this. Like, he is the money guy. He gets to be the face of it. And you're right. There have been some moments over the last 6-7 years as this team has ascended into conference finals, NBA finals, ultimately championships, where, you know, they're not exactly pulling the trophy kind of away from each other, but you can see some of that tension between those two guys. And look, I don't know about you, but I had been hearing for months now that, you know, through Pagliuca, it's kind of telegraphing this to people in the NBA that he believed he was going to get it. Like, it eventually was going to play out that he was going to get control of this team. It might take a little bit longer than people expected, but he was ultimately going to grab control of this team. And you can just tell from that statement that he's furious, that he is completely bullshit right now, that he is not going to be the majority owner of the Celtics.
Well, so I think he, from what I had heard, that he had the money to get to five, which was where they were hoping it was going to be in the fives, because that's a realistic price for a franchise that doesn't have an arena.
Yeah.
The Grousebeck side wanted more. They wanted more. They're pushing the number up. And I think one of the ways this really went sideways, there was a moment in this process where stuff was getting leaked out about the sale. And there was an unflattering piece about, you know, that it came out. And I don't even know what Wick's exact stake is, but how small Wick's stake allegedly was with the Celtics. And they're shooting too high. And there was stuff. And I don't think that went great for Pags. And whatever he may have done or not done, and maybe he did nothing. But I think there was a feeling that somebody was trying to neg the price and make it lower to try to make it. And I think you look at 90-year-old Irv Grousebeck, who's like one of the great business people of the last, like really respected as a thinker, and he's tutored a bunch of people and he's a mentor to a lot of people. And he's rich for a reason. And I don't think it went over very well that stuff started coming out that they wanted too much for the team. Because ultimately, who's saying that? It's like the Fenway group, who I don't think ever was going to try to do it anyway, or somebody that was already actively trying to buy the team and there weren't a lot of people at that point. So I think from the moment that happened, when those stories came out, it started to get dicey. And there's a lot of people in the organization who are rooting for him to get it because he was stability. It's like, if he comes in, everything will remain the same. And I think when that happened, people started getting nervous.
I would say too, Bill, like there were people rooting for him to get it. I do think
I was kind of rooting for him too, because I wanted things to stay somewhat the same.
I do think there were also people rooting for him not to get it though. Like,
yeah,
I think there was a faction there that didn't want to get it, in part because all the stuff he's saying now, and I'm sure he would have said it if he had gotten control of the team. I'm not sure everybody believes him, right? Like, I don't know that everybody believes that he would be the guy to just pour money into this team to keep it a championship contender throughout the Tatum Brown era. Like, they just didn't believe him. Like, he's got allies within the organization, but I think he also has people that are not as fond of him inside the organization. So I think it was kind of a mixed bag there. I also don't necessarily know, because like even though there was kind of a whittled down list of finalists, there were a lot of people trying to buy this team and trying to get into the mix for this team. And there were a lot of people, and I heard this through NBA, and the NBA stayed connected to the sale process. And I was hearing through those sources, like, that people were kind of grumbling over, like, how are you asking for this when you're not giving us an arena? It's just the team and all the money we're going to have to spend to. So there was a lot of people frustrated with the price. And I think it's just as likely that some of that stuff about Wick leaked out from someone not named Steve Pagliuca as it was to that it was.
That's why we don't know how it leaked out or what happened. But I think once it happened, it changed the tenor of this whole thing, where they were like, okay, fuck all you people. Now we're going to get the price we want. And there, you mentioned like there were a lot of people kicking the tires on it. You know, it was double figures. It got whittled down to five. Lori was in it, the Eagles owner, and then for whatever reason dropped out right after the Super Bowl, or before the Super Bowl, right around the Super Bowl. I think it was after, who knows? But it went from five to four. And Chisholm was the mystery guy to me. Even if you were Googling him today, there just isn't a lot of information about him. He's grew up on the North Shore, went to Dartmouth. His son plays soccer at Dartmouth and graduated in 19. He's on this like weird tech fund, hedge fund thing, and he's apparently a huge Celtics fan. And that's all we know. But this is why it's so amazing when somebody buys a team like the Celtics. You go from, I could walk by you and have no idea who you are, to now you're one of the kings of Boston. And I think Wicks had a really hard time with that over the last year, knowing that there's some end game where when you're the owner of the Celtics, the room treats you a little differently than when you're not. And I think he's aware of that.
Which, you know, leads into this idea that he's going to be, you know, the governor of this team for the next 3 years, which I believe is going to be the case, because I believe it's going to be codified in the sale agreement. Like, this is not going to be kind of whatever handshake deal Mark Cuban had with, you know, Patrick Dumont and the Adelson family. Like, I think it's going to happen.
Did he have any deal?
No, he didn't have any deal there. That's kind of what the problem was. Like, Cuban went into the sale thinking, all right, well, you know, they're going to let me do this. And all of a sudden, very quickly, it was determined that he wasn't. I do think, even if it's nominal, we're going to get Wick Grosbeck as one of the front-facing owners of this team for the next 3 years. Now, I think there are going to be problems with that, because if you're the guy footing the bill for the franchise, you're not going to have key decisions being made by someone that's got one foot out the door. Like, I think that there are certainly potential problems with that. But I think, look, Wick, all along, I've thought that Wick wanted to have his cake and eat it too. He would not be selling this team if he wasn't being forced to by his family. But because he was being forced to, he wanted to make sure that there was top dollar involved in the return, and that he would get to hold on to his place atop of the totem pole as long as humanly possible. And it sure looks like right now that's what he's going to get. Like, I had some people texting me today, you know, basically saying, don't be surprised if you see Wick kind of take some of the money that he's going to get off this and try to get back into the ownership group in
a minority owner,
slice of it, to stay kind of connected to this team. So I don't think, look, he's not going to be running the team forever, but I don't think Wick Grosbeck is going anywhere anytime soon.
So his statement, and it was funny because they released this statement from Boston Business Partners, which is the group that owns the team. Wick's the first quote in it. And he says that Chisholm asked me to run the team as CEO and governor for the first 3 years and stay on as his partner. Stay on as his partner. And I'm glad to do so. And then the next paragraph is a quote from Chisholm. I've never seen somebody buy a team and not be the first quote in the press release. Everybody was saying Wick was trying to do this, and it seems like he actually pulled it off. And you mentioned the Cuban piece. I never believed it as it was happening. It seemed inconceivable to me that somebody was going to buy a sports team and then just let somebody who didn't own that. We just don't see that really happen ever. And the times we've seen it happen were like Pat Croce and the Sixers. You be the government. And then it would always go badly within a year. So it says 3 years. It doesn't mean it's going to be 3 years. So if I gave you like the FanDuel over under and I gave you the 2.5, like boxing, 2.5 rounds. Would you go over under? If you gave me 2.5 for the over under, I don't know what I'd bet.
I go under. I just think there's too many big decisions that are made by a team governor. Like, I think, you know, Chisholm and his ownership group is going to be the ones making that decision. Now, maybe there's synergy between the two. Maybe there's no space between them, no room for daylight. They're all in lockstep. But the second they disagree on something, it's going to be Chisholm that says, it's my team. Do what you want. You want to stay in this capacity as a front-facing owner, as the governor of the team, fine, but we're doing things my way. And I don't blame him. You're putting up a valuation of $6 billion.
Blame him. Of course they should have that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's Chisholm.
Chisholm. Okay.
No, I don't know. How are you saying it?
I'm kind of saying
it. You know so little about this guy, I don't even know how to pronounce his name.
This is the thing.
I thought it was Chisholm.
I'm kind of saying it in a Massachusetts way, though. Like, we both kind of are there. Like, if I see that name, I call him Chisholm.
Can he put a social media thing on and be like, here's how to pronounce my name. Please call me Bill. I refuse to believe his name's William. It's got to be Bill. His son's name's Will, which tells me he's a Bill. So here's one of the many things that I don't get about this. For that kind of price, and you're not going to, quote unquote, be the governor for the first 3 years? I mean, now he's in his mid-50s. He graduated from Dartmouth in 91. So he's in, this is prime NBA owner, NFL owner range, like from mid-50s all the way through to mid-70s, a 20-year run. He's got the son. I have no idea if the son's going to be groomed to have a role. With Pagliuca, his son, I think, would have been a big part of it. We'll see with this. Same thing with if Laurie had gotten it. I think his son would have been a big part of it. I just find it hard to believe you're going to buy this team, do the victory lap, do the press conference, figure out where your tickets are, have these huge decisions like, oh my God, if we get bounced in round two of the playoffs, we're losing a shitload of money on top of this $200 million luxury tax bill that's coming. Let me just turn over all the decision-making to Wick. That seems crazy. And we haven't really seen it happen in anything else. So I'm like you. I'm watching it.
I'm skeptical. There's too many personnel decisions, financial decisions to just fork over to somebody that's eventually going to sell you the rest of the team or whatever it is in a period of time. I think it can last for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, but eventually something's going to come up to cause fissures between these two sides. There's just too much money at stake for me to believe that it's going to be this lasting, fruitful relationship. Now, I do think, though, Bill, like, I don't know that the new ownership group really had much of a choice with all this. Like, I think it was presented this way, like, all right, we'll sell the team, but you got to take all this with you. Like, if you don't take this, we'll go to option B. We have other offers on the table. Like, you saw, it was the Globe story back in January. There's four finalists. Like, there were people that wanted this team. And I'm sure that Wick leveraged that and used that to his advantage. Say, all right, if you want to buy this team, you're going to put up the $6.1 billion valuation, but you're also going to agree to X, Y, and Z. And that's, I think that's what they were kind of forced to stomach in order to gain control of this team.
So some of the questions that are left is, was this the highest offer? I'm going to assume it was.
Had to be.
But he's doing a lot of debt and all this stuff to whereas, because I thought it was notable, Pagliuca said in this thing, we had a real offer. He sounded like a guy who didn't get the house he thought he was going to get. It's like, I had a real offer. I offered you all cash. I don't understand why you went with this other person. They didn't offer you all cash. I don't understand the Wick part at all. And there's another piece of this too. And I'm sure you've been around the team a lot. Like, he's pretty devastated that they're selling in the first place. And he's talked about it pretty openly to people that ask him about it. And it's been a theme that has been going around the last couple months, that his dad pushed for this. His dad wanted to do it for the estate planning, all the stuff they said. But I think especially with winning the title last year, the team being really good this year, I think Wick's had a really hard time with this, even harder than maybe he's let on publicly. So staying on now for two more years, but knowing that there's an end game, it's a really weird variable. I'm excited because he's a great owner and I hope he stays on and has the same impact he had, but it's weird. I feel bad. It's weird to feel bad for somebody who just sold something for $6.1 billion, but I just don't think he wanted to sell. I don't.
He absolutely did not want to sell. This was his father, and we've covered this ad nauseum, but like his father, you know, recognizing his own mortality and figuring it's better to get your affairs in order with cash and not with the Boston Celtics. Like that's
right.
That's why. I wonder if over the next couple of years that Wick would come to appreciate the foresight of his father here. Like, I think he's getting out at exactly the right time. Like, think right. about what you accomplished in the 23 years you owned the Boston Celtics. You won two championships. You put together two kind of mini dynasties. You know, the one from the 08 to 2012, whatever it was, era, right. didn't achieve as much as it probably could have achieved if guys had stayed healthy. But you got that group together. You won a championship. You pulled off the greatest draft trade in whatever history by dealing all those picks and or getting all those picks from the Nets, and you rebuild the team that's been in two finals in 3 years and is well positioned to win another championship. Like you got an A plus for ownership.
Stuck with Tatum and Brown.
You stuck with Tatum and Brown.
And you became the best owner in Boston by 2025, hands down.
Like, imagine if like John Henry had sold the team like 10 years ago. Like what would we be thinking about John Henry now? Rather than stick around and watch this team slowly deteriorate, which it's going to eventually, right? Like maybe it takes 3 years, maybe it takes 5 years, but it's eventually going to deteriorate to the point where we're going to look at them like we look at Milwaukee.
I was feeling good. What the hell?
We're going to be looking at them like we look at Milwaukee though at some point, right? Like because they're just going to be so, you know, financially stretched that they've got to peel off some of these pieces and they're not going to be as good as they are right now. If you're Wick Grosbeck, like, you went out on top. And not only did you go out on top, you got the greatest exit strategy one could possibly have, which in the form of $6 billion, you can take your cut of and do something else. Like you've proven you are a great NBA owner. You accomplished it. You can go on. You're still relatively young. I mean, you can go on and do the next thing if you really wanted to in professional sports.
Yeah, I would say he was one of the most successful sports owners of this century.
I'd agree.
He took a team that was... had really no assets other than Pierce and no cap space and was able to rebuild it. It's the Pags piece of it.
He didn't get the Pags piece.
Well, he didn't get the Nets. He ran for governor, didn't get that. And then everyone thought he was getting the Celtics and he didn't get that. He has the Italian soccer team, but he's got to be dying today. Just dying. But I think we all felt like this was probably coming. Like I had hit a point where I wouldn't have bet on him. And I think a lot of people, but the thing that I'm going to be interested to see if it floats out over the next couple of days is, did he have any chance? Had this turned into a situation where they were like, we're just not selling to this guy?
That's the next story is, you know, we talked about the next story to figure out. Right. We talked about kind of the relationship between Wick and Pags is not what it once was. Like, how strained had that relationship become? Had it reached a toxic level to the point where Wick Grosbeck was never going to be interested in selling the team to Pagliuca? Because that, I don't know, man, you don't release a statement like that unless you're really livid at how the whole thing played out. Like
He released a statement right after they put the team for sale, right? He got one up that day too, Pagliuca.
That day, I'm in. He was the first one to get in to all that. He made it clear from jump that he wanted to be the guy that bought this team and took over its stewardship. And second, and within minutes after it being announced as being sold, he had a much stronger statement that went out there. Yeah, I think that's the next thing to figure out is, like, was this just about money? Like the fact the Celtics could get a record $6.1 billion price and, hey, if you can't meet it, you can't meet it. Or was there more to it? Was the relationship between Wick and Pags something that affected the sale of the team?
I would say yes. There's another piece with this expansion coming. That's now we've established the price, $6 billion if you want in, $12 billion. Team split it 30 ways. That's $400 million in cash the owners get. They don't share with the players. Mm-hmm. So Chisholm is buying in here at 6.1. He knows he's getting $400 billion back over the next couple of years with this expansion fee. So it's really 5.7 because that's what, you know, that's what Cuban forfeited. That's what the Grosbecks forfeited by selling now. You get that money that maybe goes to the luxury tax. I was trying to walk my dad off the ledge this morning because my dad's just like, the Luka thing has spooked my dad. He was like, you can't say, like, the new Dallas owners, everything seemed great. And then they're trading Luka Doncic for AD and a first and Max Christie. Like, yeah, I'm worried we're going to do something stupid now. I knew what we had with Wick. And it's hard to talk someone off the ledge on that.
I'm more worried though. Worried is the wrong word. Like this, you know, this year is going to play out how it's going to play out. I think the peeling off is going to be the Housers. It's going to be maybe even a Derek White. You know, the guys that you have ready-made replacements on the roster.
Derek White, what are you doing to me?
I'm not saying it's going to happen. I would say this though. I think that this team right now, as currently constructed, is only protected by championships. Like you win a championship this summer, ownership's going to bring it back, right? You're not going to blow up a team that has a chance to win.
You're not trading Jaylen Brown to the wherever.
No chance. Or even
2 weeks after the title.
Or even someone like Derek White. Like I think Sam Hauser's probably gone. Like the second he signed that contract, when you looked at what the other contracts are going to be, like I was like, there's no way Sam Hauser.
See, I was more worried about Drew. Because Drew's like low 30s and, you know, the right team that wants a vet and you think you're the Celts and you're like, this is kind of a luxury to have a guy like this. It's in that White Holiday grouping that could be the first to go. Unless I hope they keep Tatum and Brown together forever. And I love having those guys as a combo. And I think historically they have a chance to be something really special. Just two guys playing together their whole careers like that, one draft apart, winning titles. Like that's how many pairings have done that? Like, and how many pairings have fallen apart before they got to that point? So, but you know, if you're paying $130 million a year for two guys, it's almost impossible.
Yeah. I'm not concerned that something like breaking them up is on the table. But again, I do think that you're going to see some guys whacked off the payroll. You saw Baylor go off the other night, like Sam Hauser would be watching that going like, all right, I'm out the door. Like that's
right.
If that guy can do what I was doing, like, I mean, that's right. that to me is what you're looking at in the years to come. Now, if it gets bad, like if they wind up getting beat in the second round, you know, for some reason, not this year, but like next year, then I can see it slowly start to be taken apart. But for right now,
right,
it's more about the ancillary pieces and what you can replace them with. Like, look, they drafted Baylor and like, that was a surprise that they drafted him. They must've really believed in him because their payroll jumped a lot, you know, because of the guaranteed money that comes with a first round pick. They obviously believe in him and watching him go off against, was it the Nets the other night? Like that, maybe they're justified in believing that he can be the cheap alternative to Sam Hauser and be your seventh, eighth, ninth man coming off your bench.
Well, the team's in a weird spot. They're stuck at second. You have Cleveland stuck at first and the Knicks probably stuck at third and you have a month of the season left and all crappy teams for the most part on the schedule. And it's like, let's try to keep everyone healthy. Let's try to give these guys the minutes. They're doing this interesting strategy with the best guys, Tatum and Brown. They either won't play them or they'll play them real minutes. They're not doing like play 25. Like they're either playing them a playoff game minutes or not playing them. And they have the luxury to do whatever they want and try to get Shireman and people like that going. I just think they're better than the Knicks in that. If they lost to the Knicks, that would be catastrophic because they've had their number all year and everything's heading toward this Cleveland series. And Cleveland's just lost three games in a row. And for the first time, it's the Russian is cut. It's just a little bit of that. And I just think they feel like if everyone's healthy and KP's in there, we're going to be in the finals again. It seems to be the attitude, right?
Yes, that's the attitude in Boston. I would also tell you that there's not overconfidence in the front office or the coaching staff in Cleveland either. Like I just finished this story on kind of on Evan Mobley, but on a bunch of young guys in the NBA that are potential difference makers in the playoffs. And talking to people in Cleveland, even though they're 2-2 against the Celtics during the regular season, and you know they played really well in Boston coming back to win that game, they recognize that they have not yet gotten the Celtics' best shot. Like they haven't gotten, you know, that championship round haymaker, to make a boxing analogy. Yeah. And they know that's coming. They have to figure out how they don't know yet how they respond to something like that. And look, the guy that worries them the most is Kristaps Porzingis. Because look, they've got Evan Mobley, and Evan Mobley's been great all season long. But Evan Mobley does not play well against Kristaps Porzingis. You look at some of the numbers, they're not great. And that's a matchup that the Cavs know they have to dominate. Like if it's a wash between Mobley and Porzingis, the Celtics win in six. Like they have to completely dominate that matchup between Mobley and Porzingis. And I'm not sure they're capable of doing that. I think Porzingis, when he's right, both ends of the floor is great. So I think in Cleveland, they're happy with what they've done. No doubt about that. They've been surprised by a lot of things, but they're not sitting there going like, we're whatever, 10 games up on Boston. We're 10 games better. They know that a conference final series is a totally different animal.
Well, one other thing is they kind of blew the home court against OKC if they are able to get to the finals. They just lost that in 5 days.
Yeah.
They had a chance to basically control their own fate the whole way. And now OKC, and you know they'll turn it on. So from a Celtics standpoint, that's potentially looming down the road. I love the way Tatum's playing, and you know, for me, it's I just want to know who's on the team in round two. Is KP there? Am I reading stories from people like you with like, KP, hopefully in game three, he'll be back. Like if we're going down that road, I think it's gonna be really hard to win.
Yeah.
And then the West, who the F knows beyond OKC? I've changed my mind 20 times in the last week, even since we did the Sunday pod. Like I don't know what to expect in the West. So we'll see what happens.
Can I just to put a button on the sale and the team?
Yeah.
Al Horford, I think, is the first big test, right? Like, Al Horford, his contract's up, right? At the end of this year, like, he's still invaluable, right? Like, the way he's playing, you got to bring him back. Like, how much are they willing to spend? Is it a no-brainer bring him back at a two-year deal at kind of similar money as he made last time around, which is going to cost you a ton of money as well? Like, that to me is the first test of how much this ownership group is willing to spend on this team, because he's going to cost you something in real money over the course of a new deal.
Well, and there's been, if you look at the history of the team, there's been some Al Horford moments over the years where most of the time they've let the guy go and kept their fingers crossed. In this case, you could make a case he's the most beloved Celtic teammate that we've seen. I was trying to think, I was talking to somebody about this, about is anybody more loved by the people that play with him and coach him than Al Horford. Like that Laker game was so fascinating when the Lakers were going at him and he started talking shit and Tatum was talking shit. And apparently there was just a lot of shit talking on both sides. And they kept going at Al. He's talking shit. And when he came out of that game, the bench like went like crazy. They were so fired. They just absolutely love him. And I think that would be a really tough one to leave. That's not James Posey. We won a title with you. Oh, it would suck if you left. This is like, he's in the fabric. Tatum and Brown grew up with the dude, you know? So that you're right. That's probably the first big test. My feeling is if you spend that amount of money on a team and you want to impress people in the city you grew up with, you're probably going to spend money the first couple of years. But yep. We've seen these new owners come in and they're absolutely nuts. Here are my ideas. We're going to do this. We're going to zag when everybody's zigging. And it's like, oh boy, here we go.
They're still doing it. Like Matt Ishbia did that ridiculous ESPN interview where he's talking about we're building around Devin Booker and he's the guy we're going to keep. Like, not to take this a different direction, but Devin Booker is too old to win a championship in Phoenix. Simple as that. Like he's not too old to win a championship or lead a team to a championship. He's too old to lead that team to a championship.
Because that would be 5 years from now.
Yes, because he's age 29 next year. Like now is the time to sell the Celtics as a franchise to kind of bring these two together. Now is the time to sell the team. Now is the time to deal Devin Booker. If Houston comes a call in with all your draft capital, offering it back. If Oklahoma City calls and says, here's three or four players plus three or four draft picks, you are crazy if you're Phoenix and not doing that. That's some of the new owner craziness that's still out there in the league.
You think there's a new arena in 10 years?
Yes. 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 Yes.
I do too. We should have talked about that sooner. I don't see how you spend this kind of money, but then also build an arena.
There's also places you can build it. Like the Seaport's become cool again. Like it wasn't when, you know, I was younger and probably when you were younger back there, but now it's become like this cool place opposite Southie and there's room to do stuff down there.
There's stuff near 93 that the place they were looking at for the Olympics. If you go back and read the Olympic stories from 2014, there's a specific spot like past where Emerson plays soccer and lacrosse, when you're driving by going toward the Cape, there's this whole section that is the spot that they're going to make like the hub of the Olympics. And I feel like I think it's called like the rail yard or something. I think that's where the arena would go. That's really the only open spot that's in the city in the right way. Or it could be Seaport, but I mean, Seaport's already really hard to get to back and forth now. Putting 19,000 fans there would be a little rough.
They'd have to reinvent the the tee there and figure out, you know, new stops that go into that area.
I would put it right on the other side of the hill in Charlestown. We're going right in the town, like 12,000 seat arena. Let's fucking go.
I mean, that would be
we're taking our mojo back.
I would love to see it, but there's just no way. You're not buying this team and like renegotiating your lease for TD Garden, which already by NBA arena standards is old. It's bottom third in the league in terms of
well, there's another building. There's another possibility of it too, where you can, there's a second part of this where you try to buy the Jacobs side and the Bruins in the arena and try to own everything. Because if they leave that arena, the Bruins are screwed, right? Yeah. They have this 35-year-old. When was Fleet Center? 95,
I think it was. So my first year as a ball boy with the team was the first year.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
So 30-year-old arena, and then you're going to lose your basketball team in like 2000, 5 years out. I don't see it.
There's not enough U2 concerts you could put in there.
Mannix, before we go, where am I with Boccoli?
Oh, he's mentally back. May 3rd.
You told me not to bet on him.
I did.
You told me it was a money grab.
I did.
You told me he was flying across the world and had 14 hours before the fight and was just going to try to throw some bombs and it probably wasn't looking great, but he was getting paid more than he's ever been paid in his life. So I didn't sell any of my stock on your advice, but I'm still a little worried because he got his ass kicked.
I'd be less worried because it wasn't like a, you know, 8-round ass kicking. He took a shot at the top of the head that completely discombobulated him.
Yeah.
And you saw his trainer, Billy Nelson. I mean, I have Olympic gymnasts have not gone up on an apron faster than Billy Nelson got up there to throw the towel in right there. Like he was ready.
One of the early stoppages ever.
He was ready to throw that in because his guy did his job. When that first bell rang, Martin Boccoli had done his job. It was hilarious covering that out there because like Billy Nelson flew from Scotland, where he lives and usually trains Boccoli, over to Riyadh. But Boccoli had to fly like premium economy through a connection because what I was told, like the Congo doesn't allow private jets in on like short notice. Like you can't just fly a private jet in and out of the Congo. So he had to fly like Ethiopian Air, a connection through Ethiopia to get there. He got in literally 2:00 in the morning. There was no chance on God's earth.
The fight, the day before the fight, 2:00 a.m.
The day of the fight, like 2:00 a.m, day of the fight. Saturday morning, 2 a.m, he got in. And then, of course, they have him doing like 3 interviews when he gets there. Like, let the fucking guy go to bed and try to get some rest before he's got to report to work in 12 hours. I wouldn't sell your stock. He's fighting on May 3rd on this Canelo undercard over in Riyadh. He's fighting Efe Ajagba again. They're keeping that fight there. He's fully capable of beating Efe Ajagba. He didn't take really, I mean, he took one good shot. He flew over from the Congo and took one good shot, got out, got a paycheck, which I heard was about $3 million, and you know, was able to go back to work the next day. So I'd still keep my Martin Boccoli stock. He's going to weigh in the 200s for this next fight. He's probably going to beat Ajagba. I think we're once again talking about him second half of this year.
I didn't tell you, but I put a small bet on because I was in Boston for that fight.
I tried to bet Boccoli.
I know, but I can't not bet Boccoli KO. It's like a blind bet. I'm just betting it every time. I had to do it. So Canelo May 3rd. Are we excited for that fight?
I don't know.
That was your answer. When do we get Canelo Crawford?
September. So Canelo Crawford, like the worst kept secret in boxing is that Canelo Crawford is happening in September. It's going to be promoted by this new Dana White, Saudi Arabia, Nick Khan promotional company. And it's going to be on Netflix. Like that's going to be a Netflix event in September. And you know, there'll be some big names on that. This whole card on May, it's entirely designed to get Canelo that fourth title back. William Scull has that belt. So you get in that belt back, you can say Canelo is the undisputed champ going up against Crawford, the two-time undisputed champ. It just helps sell the fight. Like that's really what that card is for. It is going to be in primetime, though. I think it's interesting. Like they're going to fight
on a Saturday night.
They're going to fight in Riyadh at like 9 a.m. is what I heard, or 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning to make it primetime over in the U.S. So
wow,
it will be a good time for U.S. audiences to watch. Maybe not so much for the guys fighting on the undercard who might be fighting at 5 a.m., but it'll be interesting, that timing.
And the NFL will have started at that point and college football will be going. So It's going to be an insane weekend. Well, we'll see how much boxing Netflix does.
So Netflix,
they're definitely intrigued that that Tyson fight, I think, was a jaw dropper for them. And it seems like they're going to be dabbling a little bit more.
They, so their plan, what I was told, was to do like one big event a quarter. Like that's the mindset of Netflix. Like they're not going to try to be DAZN or what HBO was and do fights every weekend. That's not their their bag. But they are doing this Katie Taylor, Amanda Serrano trilogy fight at MSG. That's July 11th. That's going to be on Netflix. Like I said, I think the 100% sure at this point that the Canelo Crawford fight is going to be on Netflix. They're also after Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury. Like that's a fight they want to put on, which is such a huge global event. They'd love to get their hands on that for either end of this year or early next year, whenever Tyson Fury decides to rejoin the boxing ranks. So one per quarter right now is my understanding of what Netflix wants to do.
So what's the fight of the year? If you had to bet, if you have to bet on one,
like the best be fight.
Canelo so Crawford's far, not or, the fight of the year. No, just what's going to be 2025's fight of the year when it's December 31st.
So Canelo Crawford's not going to be it because I think I actually think Canelo's too big, too strong, too good. Well, I'm dying to see a Devin Haney Ryan Garcia rematch. Like, so those two guys, like that weekend, I'm going to be in New York working the three fight card that's in Times Square. That's going to be on DAZN. That's, and Ryan's at the top of the bill. Devin's at the co-main event. Both those guys are in against opponents that they can and should beat. And that would set up the rematch between them. And like, given what happened in the first
fight. This time we're not cheating the rematch?
This time, no cheating allowed rematch? This time we're using multiple. Ryan Garcia, because Ryan Garcia believes that he was screwed by the testing agency that caught him, he's using two now. He's using the one that did it the first time because he has to, and he's using another one to test him just to get verified information that he believes. But that's a big one, man. That's two 25-year-old, 6-year-old guys.
With a lot of bad blood. Like lot probably of bad the blood. Most bad Great blood that we have.
Press tour is going to be awesome. Like I'm all in for that.
All right. Mannix, great to see you.
You too.
Thank you.
You got it.
All right. Thanks to McShay. Thanks to Mannix. Thanks to Surdi and Gahau and Kyle. As always, I hope your March Madness brackets go great. Don't forget to check out Good Hang with Amy Poehler. Two episodes up. Rewatchables, Days of Thunder, Prestige TV. If you miss White Lotus, that's up there. And then Celtic City, episode 4, coming Monday night on HBO and Max. Larry Bird shows up. And guess what? He was really good at basketball. So that's what we got. I will see you on a Sunday. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. For Kansas, and affiliation with Kansas Star Casino, or 18 plus and present in D.C. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. Call 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut or visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland. Hope is here. Visit Gambling Helpline, ma.org, or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts, or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.